From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
I really enjoy sales. It's some people are not into that, but I really enjoy thinking about a product. I enjoy meeting customers, and I enjoy the thrill of the chase and getting someone to sign a dotted line. I get a big kick out of that.
I'm Connor Carney, and that's the voice of Laurie Keogh, adjunct associate professor at Trinity College Dublin and founder of Blockchain Ireland. Laurie is a former partner of Deloitte in Hong Kong and up until recently was the managing director of Consensus, Ireland's largest blockchain consultancy. In this conversation, we talk about blockchain technology and its real-world applications, why Laurie decided to leave a partnership in a global consultancy in pursuit of building a business, and how teaching has helped his leadership skills. Pay close attention towards the end of this episode when Laurie talks about how to invest in cryptocurrencies and what we should think about when trying to value this emerging asset class. I started off by asking Laurie about his early days and his very first job.
I started my career in Accenture, had a fantastic time there, learned, I guess, how to be a business analyst, learned how projects work, how big programs work, and had a fantastic 5.5 years there working primarily in financial services, and then had a great opportunity to join Deloitte's financial service consulting team as it was just really starting. Going from a big machine, which is Accenture, to being a, I guess, part of a small team and trying to build it within Deloitte. So when I joined, I think I was employee number 11 in that team. And by the time I left Deloitte in Ireland, it was, I think, 150 people. So it was a fantastic journey, great people, and yeah, lots of great clients.
Did you end up in Asia at one stage?
So this was a good part of the story. So yeah, what happened here, I was going back and forth to Hong Kong a lot. So towards the last couple of years of my time in Deloitte in Ireland, I set up Deloitte's Europe, Middle East and Africa blockchain lab with a great bunch of people. And the guys in Hong Kong wanted me to go out there and to help them set up their blockchain lab for Asia Pacific that was based out of Hong Kong, based on what we did right and wrong in Dublin. I was part of a team that sold a piece of work to the regulator and a bunch of banks, and it resulted in me going back and forth from Dublin to Hong Kong several times over about an 18-month period. And Hong Kong's a fantastic city, really, really loved it there. Mm-hmm. And I was asked if I would join Deloitte Hong Kong as a partner, to which I accepted. And then kind of like a Dublin bus, I guess, there are none for several hours and then two come along at once. Mm-hmm. And Consensus came knocking on the door and asked me if I'd be interested in setting up a team and a business in Ireland from scratch. And I initially said no, and I didn't really know what to do. And I used Jeff Bezos's regret minimization framework, where you picture yourself at 80 looking back at your life and what would you regret more? And I thought, I may never get a chance to start a business in that way from mm-hmm. scratch in my home city, in my home country, with that level of support. So I decided to, I guess, scratch that entrepreneurial itch and roll the dice. And I declined the partnership then, mm-hmm. And then set up Consensus in Ireland.
Before we talk about Consensus, I want to just come back a little bit and talk about blockchain technology. It's something that fascinates me because I kind of see it as a kind of an exciting space. People who are involved with it are really excited about it. People who understand it are excited about it. But I don't understand it fully. So in the most simple terms possible, can you explain what blockchain is and what some general applications of that might be?
I guess in a very simple form, blockchain technology or distributed ledger technology is ultimately a shared ledger, which is accessible by multiple parties simultaneously. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to achieve increased transparency amongst the different players. You're trying to increase efficiency by reducing, if not eliminating, reconciliations and things of that nature. And it, it really gets just more complicated based on the applications that you want to use it for, much like any other problem and any other technology that's out there. Mm-hmm. But another way, and the way I kind of explain blockchain technology is that there's four key parts. So the first part is number one, and people have asked me, hey, Laura, you need to, if you can't explain what blockchain is in the back of a napkin, you know, this meeting, there won't be a second meeting. So I got good at explaining it on the back of a napkin. So the first point on the napkin that I draw is this thing called immutability. And immutability basically means that something that is recorded on a blockchain is there and is there forever. It's very hard to edit, amend, or alter that information. So what you get then is a really good data trail or audit trail of what happened and when and who did what. So a really good data set. Now, that's not to say, it's very important to note that blockchain doesn't magically remove bad data. If it's bad data that's entered or inaccurate data, then that's what's recorded. So I think I'd be, you know, a very successful individual if I managed to solve the kind of data cleansing piece. Mm-hmm. So immutable is a key feature, and we'll talk more about that in terms of applications. But when it comes then to talking about provenance of goods, how a good is made, where it comes from, and being able to demonstrate authenticity, it ends up being a great application of the technology. Mm-hmm. A second feature of the technology are things called smart contracts. And smart contracts are, I guess, buzzwords around what blockchain is, but it is a self-executing contract when certain criteria are met. If this event happens, trigger this payment is a typical example. And a frequent one that I use would be talking about travel insurance. So if you buy travel insurance and your flight is delayed, not a whole lot of that going on for any of us right now, but in the past and hopefully in the near future, you typically then have to go online, fill out a form, and you get some of your money back minus the excess. So you've had a negative experience, you've paid for a product, you have to go online, do some homework and do admin, mm-hmm. and then you get some of your money back. So it's not an incredible customer experience. And if you were to think about, let's say, Revolut, it probably wouldn't be an experience that Revolut would roll out, right? There's far too much friction there. So what blockchain looks to do is to, how do we remove that friction and simplify the process whereby if a flight is delayed more than, let's say, 4 hours, that 1 second after that 4 hour delay, money then goes automatically into your designated or selected bank account where you don't have to fill in forms or anything like that. It just automatically happens. Mm-hmm. Now that's a great customer experience. And so the technology is looking for ways, much like it's the how do you solve problems and where can blockchain technology be used to uniquely solve those and add value. Mm-hmm. So they are smart contracts. Third then is in relation to decentralized. And what decentralized mean is there's no one single owner of the data. So I would have an instance of the data set. So would you and anybody else and all your listeners out there as well. They would all have a copy. So if something happened to my data, well, then you know what? I can refer to yours or anybody else in the network. But also what it means is that if I try and kind of do things or spend more money, and you know from an accounting perspective and your business, if I try and do something that's inaccurate, everybody else in the network will see. And they're basically able to say, Laura, you don't have the funds to do that. And therefore, that transaction won't be processed and won't get added to the blockchain, as the case may be. And that's the third area. And the fourth is it's cryptographically very secure. So blockchain's been around for 11 years, the Bitcoin blockchain being the first one and probably the most famous. And that really has resulted in the underlying technology not being hacked or compromised once in that period, which is actually a pretty serious deal now as we're into over a decade. Now, there's been instances where wallets have been tampered with. And by wallets, I mean places where people go to buy cryptocurrency, and some of those entities haven't had amazing security or privacy. So think of it as if, you know what, you physically have your wallet and you put it in a zip pocket in your inside coat pocket. Well, then that's kind of somewhat secure. But if you leave your wallet half hanging out of the back pocket of your jeans, you know, it's easy for people to steal. And that's what happened in some of those crypto exchanges. They had poor security and I guess nefarious actors came in and took advantage of that.
So you mentioned Revolut there as a way of kind of talking about customer experience and the ease of which these transactions can happen. But I suppose Revolut isn't really built on a blockchain technology. What are the applications? How might these things, this technology that we're talking about and all the benefits, how are they kind of manifesting themselves in businesses, our things, our services, our softwares that people are using and they're using in their businesses to make things better?
Okay, a great question. And the honest answer to that is slowly, is what I would say. So I've been working in the blockchain space for the last kind of 6 years, and I thought adoption would be much faster than it has been, especially at an enterprise level. But what I would say is that there are unique instances where blockchain lends itself very well to adding value. And then there are a lot, and the vast majority of instances, where blockchain is not appropriate to solve that problem or add value for the scenario that, let's say, a financial services company is in. Like, for example, we mentioned digital transformation. You know what, if you're trying to do cost saving, blockchain will probably not be the way to go on that front. But if you're trying to develop perhaps new products, new propositions into a market, then perhaps blockchain should be explored in addition to other technologies as well in order to do that. So I think, and look, I've been guilty of this in the past myself. So it's really important not to get blinded by the technology versus the problem you're trying to solve or the value you're trying to create. You know, and Jeff Bezos will adamantly talk about the importance of focusing on the customer. And I think it's really, really true. So don't let the tail wag the dog. Focus on the customer. What are their needs and wants? How does the solution meet those needs and wants? And then you're figuring out what the technology is that forms a solution that meets and even preempts those needs and wants. And it definitely should be in that order. So there's a bunch of times where I was in Deloitte or Consensus where we would have openly said to clients, you know what? I know you really want to do some blockchain stuff, but really you don't need blockchain for what you want to do. And as a salesperson, that's a really hard conversation to have. You're watching money walk out the door, but that's when you're trying to build relationships that aren't just going to be a, I guess, a one-time transaction or one-time purpose.
Sure. I don't know if you can talk about this, but can you think of an example whereby you implemented blockchain technology in a business and what that did for that business?
Absolutely. So one of the largest blockchain implementations at enterprise level that I was involved with was to build a trade finance platform. And trade finance is ultimately large loans, large things called letters of credit, which are normally loans of 10 million, 20 million, 30 million. And basically, there were a couple of problems that were coming up that needed to be addressed. And people were looking for new ways of solving those problems to see how they would stay relevant and add value in the future. And one of the problems was that if I had a business case and I went to bank A and said, hey, I need 20 million to buy scrap metal, blah, blah, blah. Then the bank, let's say, gives me 20 million. I would then go with the same business case to bank B and ask for another 20 million. And because bank A doesn't talk to bank B about this topic, I then get two loans for the same thing. And that's called fraud. So what this company wanted to do is create a platform for multiple providers to be able to see that if I came along asking for that loan, that a flag would be raised if I got access or if I requested funds or funding for the same business case. Now, what's really important here is that you don't want to disclose competitively sensitive information. So you just really want to show the bare minimum. Has Laurie approached your business? Yes or no is really the kind of main thing. You don't want to get into too much on what terms and what was the deal and all that good stuff. But also another challenge around trade finance was it takes a very long time to actually issue a letter of credit, which is that loan. So it can be like 10 days. So it's a very laborious process. It was also very paper-based, so it wasn't digital. Whilst in Consensus, I was part of a team that won a large project working with 10 global banks. So the likes of ABN AMRO, Citi, MUFG, SocGen, Rabo, a bunch of others, and Shell to create a trade finance platform as to how letters of credit would be issued cheaper, better, faster. So it went from taking 10 days to taking an hour to issue a letter of credit. So significant saving there. You're into the 95 plus percent, you know, efficiency category. Also, over $1 billion worth of value has gone through the platform to date. It went in production in 6 months, and a bunch of other features are now being built on top of it. So I think in that instance where blockchain was able to provide transparency to multiple parties simultaneously, where it was able to be used to create efficiency of the issuance of this letter of credit. I think in that instance, blockchain made a bunch of sense. So I think trade finance was a great application of the technology. So there's one anyway.
if I try and think about it from an accounting perspective, and excuse me for talking about accounting, but if I take a restaurant, for example, and a restaurant has transactions, you know, they're buying from their food suppliers, they've got staff costs and things like that, and then they have sales to customers and things like that. Does it work in the sense that you have a supplier that might be on this blockchain, a restaurant that might be on the blockchain, and then you're kind of getting rid of the invoicing, supplier statement reconciliation, because everyone knows that what's happening has happened based on what the record says?
And that's exactly it. That is like fantastic example. Now, the next question that I would have is, or next set of questions would be, and these are questions that I get typically asked, or certainly did get typically asked, were, how is it better than what we've got today? Because there's a lot of great technology solutions out there that are already doing pretty well, that are very mature, and that are industry standard, as the case may be. So a new solution in this space has to have a compelling business case that either does things in a cheaper, better, faster way, or in a totally different way that is disrupting the market. So this is where, you know, the creation of the business case and the benefits associated with that blockchain can add need to be really, really clear. So how, if I was to use blockchain in that scenario, how is it better? What are the benefits to me and all of the different entities as part of that deal or that ecosystem? And also, how much is it going to cost to roll out? And what are the risks with the implementation of it? And who's going to support it? Mm-hmm. So these are all the types of, these are the good questions that people are asking about the technology, because they're all the questions that anyone would ask of any technology, not just a blockchain. So any of your listeners are out there who are thinking about, you know what, if I was to use blockchain potentially between all those parties that you mentioned in that example, which is a really good example, by the way, they're the questions they should be working through before people start. And like I said, I learned from my own mistakes here, before you get blinded by the technology rather than the value. And I think when speaking with a lot of companies, we will get excited, or I would have got excited, and the client would have got excited. But then when we start to really go through the analysis, you know what, this is probably going to cost quite a lot of money to implement, and therefore it's not really viable. Or the business benefits that they anticipated were there might be half, and therefore they'll say, you know what, that's just not enough for us to roll this out right now.
So take you know, SaaS products and kind of cloud products that have really revolutionized some of these areas in business in recent years. I suppose you talked about adoption there earlier, and because there was, let's say, money to be made from a provider of these softwares like Salesforce.com, for example, because they were able to make money off the back of it, perhaps that has helped them, you know, capitalism being what it is, they can raise money, build a business around that. If the ledger and the kind of nature of the technology is distributed, whereby no one really owns the actual data set, or no one really, there's no kind of core business in the middle providing this, is that a problem in terms of the adoption and in terms of someone actually trying to improve some of these systems because they basically can't make any money off it?
Yeah, a very good question, right? So ultimately, who owns the data? And if no one owns the data, no one can monetize it, right? Mm-hmm. And very good point. And really, this goes back to, why are you using blockchain, and what's the purpose? So what's the problem you're trying to solve? And that's the key thing here. So Salesforce, I think they've done some work in relation to blockchain themselves, right? Unsurprising, they've got obviously huge amounts of money to do lots of incredible R&D and a very successful company. What I would say in that scenario is, Where I've worked with multiple parties, whether it's on KYC or other things, is that they're coming together because they're facing an industry problem that is of no, it's not a competitively differentiating, and they want to figure out a way how they might work together to lower the costs of them doing that specific function. What they'll initially try to do is, right, what's the problem? What are the ranges of solutions that are out there? Does blockchain add value? Yes or no? Let's say it does. Then what's the way where they can share the least amount of information with the group or with each other so that they can get the business benefit that they wanted at the start? Mm-hmm. And that is just working closely with all the different players, working through the different scenarios. And eventually, what will end up typically happening is the lawyers come out, and it will be that everybody signs up to an agreement that in this new scenario or initiative, there are an agreed set of, I guess, rules or performance rules, which everybody has to sign up to. And if people really don't follow those, they might get kicked out. So to give you an example, in KYC, so know your customer is hard work, right? Very important work, and you get fined billions if you do it wrong due to anti-money laundering related rules.
For the benefit just of the listener, know your customer is, let's say, for a solicitor or an accounting practice or someone who's about to provide a service or a bank, they just need to find certain things out about the person who's applying for the product. So maybe an ID or just proof of address and things like that. That's what we're talking about here, is it?
That's exactly it. Okay. That's exactly it. So specifically financial institutions in this example would be required, you know, for you to set up a bank account, you have to be able to demonstrate you are who you say you are and that you're not a criminal, that you're not on a sanctions list, you're not a terrorist and all that kind of good stuff. Mm-hmm. So basically all these financial institutions have to KYC people all the time. And what has typically happened is there's all sorts of customers. I'm a customer of one bank, but I'm also a customer of several others. So I get KYC'd over and over again, and the banks have to repeat this process over and over again for the same set of customers. Mm-hmm. So it was an idea that we had where could we create a scenario where I get KYC'd by one institution, and that attestation that Laurie is who he says he is then can be passed on to the other institutions so they don't need to repeat the process, therefore saving lots of time and money on processes that really achieve the same outcome, except they're just repeated over and over and over again. They cost lots of money. It slows down the customer experience for me because I need to go through that exercise. When if I know I've been approved once, then I'm able to then go to another bank and then perhaps be able to buy their products, you know, in 5 steps instead of 50. So there's a potential application of the technology where blockchain would be used to store that attestation that Laurie is who he says he is. And then basically somebody, I would have a QR code and a bank would be able to scan that QR code and then it'd be able to say, oh, I see you've already been validated, so we don't need to go through that onboarding process. You can now buy whatever products.
In each of these examples, you know, how expensive are these networks to set up?
There are instances where you spot a good application of the technology and you might then try to convene that group to create that ecosystem. And then it's up to, I guess, the individual or the company's ability to demonstrate a potential business case in terms of cost saving or new business. And then on the other side of that, there's also, I guess, the pull factor where customers or clients themselves have come up with, they know what the problems are better than anybody. And then they request companies like a Consensus or a Deloitte or whoever to tender to develop a solution with them. Mm-hmm. So ideally, and the faster ones are where the industry participants have already identified the problem and they're already far down the road in terms of what they want. That's normally the faster path.
So it must be more difficult, like if I think about someone who's trying to start a SaaS company now based on cloud software, they can kind of get some sort of a product together and go out and start selling it to people, kind of a minimum viable. But in this case, you kind of have to have, and maybe that's why Consensus was called Consensus, you have to have, you know, everyone buying into it before there's even a product.
Yeah, and I guess where Consensus, Deloitte, Accenture, whomever it was or is, who is working on blockchain, is that some companies may want to be the first company to start this process. So they'll go, look, we have this business problem. We know we're not the only ones, but we want to develop a solution. So we'll be the first name on the sheet before we start, you know, inviting other people to join. Mm-hmm. They may then set up a separate company and they will have the majority share ownership of that company, as the case may be, or the biggest piece of the pie. But I do think, to your point, are there a lot of applications where blockchain can be used on a single company basis? That's probably not where the main benefits of technology is. You know, I guess it is like, you know, that old kind of saying, it is like developing a phone where you just develop one end of the phone. If you're developing the technology with a solution for only one company in mind, it is a technology that's best shared with friends.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Let's go back and just talk about you for a while and your career to date. Did you start your career as a lecturer?
I did, actually. I started very fortuitously. I was doing a master's and I got asked to be a teaching assistant and I accepted. I was incredibly nervous. I remember that day quite well. My hand was shaking as I was opening up the screen to open up my presentation and everybody could see the kind of cursor shaking. I ended up having a fantastic group. This was with the National College of Ireland. And really, really nice group of people and ended up really enjoying it. And I was asked then, my boss at the time, Dr. David Keane, he then got promoted to be the Dean of the School of Business and Humanities, and he asked me to take over his lecturing. So I spent 2 years lecturing full time. That was my first job, which was, it was fantastic. It allowed me to surf a lot, which was great. So that was my first job. And then I went into Accenture, then Deloitte, then Consensus.
And what was it about teaching that appealed to you? What was it that you really enjoyed when you were in NCI?
When you're teaching, there's no one else there. It is all on you. So I played a lot of team sports, I guess, growing up. And this is one of those points where I had to be totally accountable all the time for everything that was happening. And that, I guess, motivated me to prepare and also how to think on my feet quickly. If I didn't know the answer to a question, how do I figure out, what's the best way to answer that question while still showing credibility? I think that was probably a really important thing, but also fundamentally, I guess, communicating, right? Understanding how to effectively relay important, lessons and business messages from the textbook. I won't say it my career at that early stage, but I used a textbook called Integrated Strategic Management by Hill and Jones. It's a really good textbook. So that was really what my job was all about. And I just really enjoyed, I think, the back and forth of interacting with other human beings.
Mm-hmm. And I won't put words in your mouth, but I'll ask, how beneficial has that ability to communicate complicated things in a simple way to other people? How has that benefited you in the rest of your career and other roles that you've had?
And great question. And I think that as I get older, I'm nearly 40 now, it's one of these things where you don't know something until you teach it. So you've got to know it. And that ability to communicate, although perhaps wasn't a vital part of my early career with Accenture, as I got, further up in Deloitte into manager, senior manager, director, partner stuff, my job became far more about communicating to the team, communicating with clients, communicating to the market. And for me, that became a differentiator between me and my peers. And I don't hopefully say that or doesn't come across in an arrogant way, but it was this kind of 10,000 hour rule, Malcolm Gladwell talks about that and The Tipping Point and a number of his books, where the Beatles, had this. They were an overnight success, but they'd been busking and playing in all sorts of bars for so long. They were, they'd play in bars all day and then they would start recording at night and repeat the process. And the opportunity that I had with NCI and then with Trinity, I've been lecturing there for the last, 13 years. I've clocked up a lot of hours understanding what works when it comes to communication, when it comes to teaching. And it's given me an opportunity to test lots of stuff out, to learn from what didn't work and learn from my own style, and also to learn how to talk to and work with some groups and versus other groups. So working with senior part-time students who are coming from, let's say, an information technology background versus working with undergrads in marketing, and how your style needs to differ right the way through to working with executive MBAs and even doing exec education and how your style needs to fit to meet their needs, which are all very different.
Yeah, like it is something I've noticed, working for other people in businesses, the CFO or, the managing director in a lot of cases, they don't actually do a lot of technical work. You know, there's strategy and everything, but their job for the most part seemed to me to be teaching. On some level, it was just teaching people around them what to do, how to do it, and why. And it seems to be a quite an important leadership trait in these higher up positions.
Yeah, look, that's I hope, I think that's the sign of a good leader. And I've been fortunate to work for several very strong individuals that I have learned a bunch from and still am. And I think that's a really important trait for anybody, right? Whatever you work, you want to be working with other people where you're learning. I think that means you're going to be somewhere where you're going to stay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me about some of the people who have influenced your thinking and who you've learned from over the years.
A whole lot of people. I mentioned Dr. David Keane there. So David has a great book called Deliberate, which is really all about helping, I guess, people be the best people they can be, and with the focus on being strong business operators. And each letter stands for a different thing, as the case may be. But it is a fantastic book. So a plug for him and a plug for the book. But he was somebody, right, I had never taught before. And it's one of these funny things in life. He gave me an opportunity. He saw something in me that potentially I could do a little bit of teaching or be his teaching assistant. And honestly, that changed my career. And without sounding cheesy and corny about it, but it probably changed my life. And honestly, how it happened was, I remember it. I was interested in the subject that we were covering. I think we were talking about value chains. And I remember I just read up on the topic. And one day he asked me a question about it. And I actually, for one of the rare moments in my academic life, I knew the answer. And I was able to have a good conversation about it. And I think he thought I had read up everything every week. And I just got really lucky. And that changed. Yeah, that I wouldn't be talking to you here right now otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about, we've talked about your strengths, I suppose, in communication and how that's helped your career. Have you noticed over the years any weaknesses that you might have in either running a business or just in business in general? And how have you dealt with those?
Yeah, what would I say? And look, I've made lots of mistakes, and I'll make many more to come. And yeah, it's definitely about recognizing those and trying to figure out how to address them. I'm definitely not amazing at admin, let me tell you. That's probably a play for your business. So working with partners that take that pain away, I think, is an important thing. Mm-hmm. And understanding that there are solutions out there that do make it easy. And secondly, I think where I found weaknesses, I try and find people that I can work with that are better at those things than I am, and they enjoy doing those things. And then it's about me absolutely getting out of the way and letting them own that space. This isn't an area that I'm particularly good at. I know it's an important part of the business, and trying to partner with them so that we can, I'll do my thing, they do their thing, and we reach the overall common goal. The admin side of things, I think, is an important area where I need to, stay on top of.
Is it hard to find people to fill those roles that you're not very good at doing, based on the fact that you don't have a good knowledge or understanding of them? Is it hard to hire people for those roles because of that?
Look, through all the stuff that's available online, I think you can learn enough to be, reasonably dangerous on a lot of topics. And it becomes, when working with people, it becomes, are they an expert in their field? And I think you can probably figure that out quite quickly. And then the question really is, and this goes for all employers, it's, can I work with that person? And can I work with that person over an extended period of time? As we work together, can we manage, other people together? Can we manage the business? Can we grow the business? Are they going to be able to manage other people as well? So it becomes far more about the team and the collective, I guess, rather than me getting into the weeds about their ability to execute the job. So like there's definitely an element of trust. I look, Connor, I'm sure as you do, I have a network. So if there's an area, let's say I'm looking to hire a head of technology, I use my network to help me validate that person actually does know all the things they need to know. And then it's about trust, And it's about, certainly when working with people, it's about me getting out of the way and letting them do their thing.
That's actually interesting, what you were saying there about a head of technology. I suppose from a consulting background and the business of Consensus, would have been in a way project managing these projects for clients, and I suppose understanding what that client needs and not trying to sell them something that they don't need, like we spoke about before. Do you understand the ins and outs of how blockchain technology is built, you know, how it's coded? And if not, was it kind of difficult to build a team and to be a managing director of a company like that? Or did you actually need to know the technical aspects of it in order to build such a business?
I know what I don't know, which is vast. and that is, I guess that's the first step. But from when I was in Deloitte, when I was in Consensus, I worked with a fantastic guy called Owen Connolly, who was the technology director of Deloitte's EMEA Blockchain Lab and then in Consensus. And Owen is a hugely knowledgeable individual. And I was really fortunate to work with Owen, because if there was a question that came up, honestly, 99% of the time, Owen would know the answer. So if I was doing sales, I would meet clients. We'd have a conversation about the problem or the product that we wanted to create. And then the follow-up meeting, Owen would be in the room. So we could bring it down to a level of, how do we build this? Mm-hmm. Why should blockchain be used? How would it add value? How much would it cost? And then I'd work with Owen very much around, I guess, trying to build that proposal, build a business case. And then if we won the work, I'd work with Owen to deliver the project. Owen would be the tech lead on the project. I would, I guess, as you said, run the project, run the program to make sure that we were on track, on budget, delivering as per the client's requirements. But Owen was doing all the magic in the background on the blockchain and the tech front.
Yeah, the reason I ask that is because when I look on a very small sample size, when I look at these companies that have done very well quite quickly, something I've noticed is that the founder doesn't actually understand necessarily or doesn't know how to do the technical service of the business. So like if I liken it to an accounting business, you know, the most successful accounting businesses have actually been built by people who aren't accountants. You know, they're built as a company who just provides accounting services, and the head of that company isn't necessarily an accountant. And in your case, would you consider yourself a technologist in that respect, or have you kind of just played to your strengths throughout?
I spent most of my career in Accenture and Deloitte working on technology related projects. So big system implementations, small system implementations. So I have a good understanding, I guess, of the technology landscape, technology architecture, the different solutions that are out there, as what people would call traditional technology solutions, what they can and can't do. And it was honestly, I came across blockchain and I just found it really interesting. And I had time to read up about it. And then Deloitte were very kind to give me time to actually spend more time. So then I ended up being on page two when everyone else was on page one. That enabled me to, I guess, see things perhaps maybe a little bit before others. And Deloitte backed me to build a team. And like I said, then it's about, you know, am I going to be the person who develops or who writes the code? No. And that's where Owen needs to come in. And a lot of times Owen wasn't writing code. He designed the solution and he'd oversee the people who are writing code. That's kind of, yeah, the example that I give. I guess I saw an opportunity and had enough knowledge to be dangerous to develop an offering around it. And then, yeah, I got lucky.
Do you think that has been a strength, not necessarily having to be the person that builds the technology?
Geez, I'd love to be a really good developer, to be honest. I really would. I think it would lead to, you know, maybe that would lead to me developing products on my own or developing other business opportunities and reducing the time frame to get products out the door. I don't know. I really enjoy sales. It's some people are not into that, but I really enjoy thinking about a product. I enjoy meeting customers and I enjoy the thrill of the chase and getting someone to sign a dotted line. I get a big kick out of that.
You talked earlier, or you mentioned about surfing. Is that something you do a lot of still?
A lot of, unfortunately not. I went surfing last week for the first time in a while, which was amazing. I've been in Sligo. It is, yeah, it's definitely my happy place or my form of meditation. I don't meditate. I probably should, but it's a great way to jump in the car. And then you're immersed in, you know, you're immersed in nature, you're immersed in the the ocean's energy. You're looking around at fields and hearing birds, you're listening to the waves, and you're having fun and exercising. So for me, that is, and that was another one of these things that changed my life. I made a deal with a friend of mine when we were on a J1 in San Diego a long time ago that I teach him, you know, how to do weights, and he teach me how to surf it. And after the second day, we gave up the weights thing and just focused on surfing, and that was the end of it.
Over your career and all the people you've met and interacted with, what would you say is the best piece of advice you've gotten?
Yeah, my dad gave me great advice, I think. And I was probably too immature. I won't say too young, so I probably wasn't that young. And he just said, you know, much like life, business, our huge part of business is all about interpersonal relationships. And I guess especially when it comes to sales. I think the ability, and I think Irish people specifically have an unbelievable ability to communicate and interact with others. So I love going to the States and interacting with folks over there. You know, you mention you're Irish or they hear your accent and you've people warm to you because of that. So I feel very fortunate about that. So I think interpersonal relationships are really important. I think a second piece is definitely in relation to constantly focusing on a customer, whoever that is, if that's a big institution, if it's an individual, or in my case, for certainly a portion of my time, it's the students that I teach. They are customers, and understanding what their expectations are and delivering on those and trying to exceed those. And then I think the third thing is definitely about resilience. You have your own business. I'm sure you know all about this. You're doing something on your own. There'll be setbacks. There are ups and downs, and having the, I think, mental toughness to realize, you know what, things aren't exactly where I want them to be, but we're moving forward, and knowing that you might have to change things along the way. I think resilience is an incredibly important lesson, not just around business, but in life.
Because it doesn't always go in a straight line, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I, you know what? I don't know if I would want it to.
Yeah. Tell me about the future of blockchain. Where is all this going? You know, where do you foresee this kind of ending up and what might happen in the future?
For me, blockchain started with cryptocurrency, which is Bitcoin. And then, you know what? A lot of people became interested in it. And then this swept the attention focus to enterprise blockchain applications. There's been a few really good successes in that area, but not as many as people would have hoped. And now the dial is back on cryptocurrencies and crypto assets and central bank digital currencies. So I feel like it's kind of done a 360. We're back to kind of where we started. And people ask me, and I think about this quite a lot, people ask me, what's the best application of blockchain technology? My heart and my head now are going, well, there was one application, which is cryptocurrency, and it might be that the killer application of blockchain technology was the first application, and that is going back to cryptocurrency. So I think there, over the next 12, 24 months, there was an announcement from the EU about how they're going to handle crypto assets and markets and crypto assets. That announcement actually came out yesterday. So I think there's going to be a lot of work done in the central bank digital currency space, in the stable coin space. And I also think you're going to start to see a lot more people using specific debit cards. So Gemini have a debit card, let's say, where you're able to basically use your phone to pay for things. So instead of opening, let's say you go up to the register or whatever and you tap your Revolut account, you tap your phone, you'll be actually debiting your Bitcoin account from your, let's say, Gemini provider, and you'll be able to pay for goods and services on a much more routine basis. And I think that will be another big installment and adoption of of cryptocurrencies and blockchain over the coming months.
What would be the benefit? Like, if I think about Revolut, you know, if I need to buy something in USD, great, you know, because it's in USD, because I'm assuming that company is in America, or likewise with the UK or something like that. So I understand currencies from that standpoint. What's the benefit to myself or Joe Public of buying something with a debit card that's actually blockchain rather than euro?
Crypto-based. So basically, the key thing here is that people who have, let's say, Bitcoin or Ether or any other coin is, how do you use that? Like, ultimately you buy it, you hope it goes up in value, you sell it, and you have to pay for capital gains tax, by the way, on that, everybody, before people get too excited, which if I'm not mistaken is 33%. But ultimately, what I want to be able to do is I want to be able to live off my crypto, right? So if I buy Bitcoin at $5,000 and it goes to $10,000, I want to be able to perhaps spend that in a way which is easy for me to do. And it wasn't easy to do that. It wasn't easy to get in and get out. And it was expensive to do so. When now companies like Coinbase, like Gemini that I mentioned, you're able to just tap your phone and it will debit your Bitcoin balance for that coffee that you buy. And you're starting to use Bitcoin in the real economy. So that's just really the benefit. And that wasn't there before because it was hard to do. It took too long and it was expensive. So I think we're going to start to see just the ability to be able to spend cryptocurrencies in the real economy a far more frictionless way.
Are the debit cards produced by Visa or MasterCard, or are they totally separate?
So in the US, I'm just trying to think offhand. In the US, the Gemini one that I know for sure is in partnership with a company called Flexa. So as those companies roll out cards in the UK and here in Ireland, I'm sure they'll be in association with, yeah, I think you're spot on. I think it'll probably be with Visa or MasterCard. And MasterCard and Visa are doing all sorts of blockchain related projects. They're all over it. MasterCard have a blockchain team here in Ireland. Dave Fleming, a former colleague of mine from Consensus and Deloitte, a guy called Miguel Rojo is part of that team as well. They're doing a lot of great work. And MasterCard and Visa are, you know, fantastic businesses, make huge amounts of money. So they're able to really spend lots of money in R&D. So I think they're doing all sorts of cool stuff behind the scenes.
Do you understand what determines the value of a Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency?
I do. And that is the market. That is you and me. Mm-hmm. It is supply and demand of what the market decides that it's worth. So at the moment, right, and it changes obviously in every nanosecond, like other currencies, the market is saying that Bitcoin is worth around, you know, $10,000 or $10,500. And that is because of a whole range of reasons. But typically when Bitcoin goes up or Ether goes up, I get messages on my phone going, should I buy, should I sell, or what do I do? And they ask me what's going on. And all I can do is I can have theories, but sometimes the market is incredibly irrational and far more irrational than an equity market or a bond market, mm-hmm. because there's an earnings report comes out, it's not as good as people would have hoped or analysts would have hoped, and therefore the stock drops, or COVID hits, stock drops. In the crypto world, it's more opaque than that. It's not as this happened and the price has gone down. There mm-hmm. have been instances where prices should have gone up and they stayed. And actually, during COVID, I thought Bitcoin would go higher because we've entered into a period of instability. People flock to more secure assets. Bitcoin is meant to be the digital gold. So I actually thought Bitcoin would maybe hit $15,000, mm-hmm. but it didn't. Ultimately, it is the price that you and I are willing to pay.
And what might determine that? You know, what determines the supply and demand metrics in the case of, let's say, Bitcoin? I suppose one part of the demand is people see the value going up, but not really understanding why it's going up, might just say, well, I think it's going to go up further, so I'll buy into it. I'm assuming that's one part of it. Is there a fundamental or kind of a more rational approach to figuring that out?
A fundamental part of how Bitcoin is, I guess, it was made was that there'll only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. There's about 16 million Bitcoin in circulation. So there is a finite supply of Bitcoin. The last Bitcoin will be produced in 2143. And this is the way that the protocol has been designed and programmed. So that is what's going to happen. And that is a definite thing. So technically, the way Bitcoin works is that it's based on supply and demand. And as time goes on, you know, there is an increased demand for Bitcoin and a reducing or ever reducing supply, which is meant to mirror gold. So therefore, as supply decreases and demand increases, price should go up. And that's why there's all sorts of papers written by people far more intelligent than me about, you know, Bitcoin will one day reach $100,000 or $500,000. $500,000 is probably a bit of a stretch, certainly right now, but you know, it's as I said, it's floating around $10,000 at the moment. And it's where I think there is the opportunity for cryptocurrencies of all sorts, but primarily Bitcoin and to a lesser extent Ether, to really increase in value is when institutions like the large banks start purchasing it, start trading it, and it starts getting into the pension fund world. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, we have individual people like me, Joe Public, buying Bitcoin. But then now there's hedge funds, there's family offices, they're buying it and they're trading it. And it's the moment at which the big institutions start getting into it, then you're going to see a zero will be added to the price of it. I do believe that. Now, the real question is around compliance, security, and risk and risk aversion. You know, large banks are risk averse. Actually, most banks are risk averse. So I think what every bank is probably waiting to see is who's going to be the first large bank to really get into crypto. And then I imagine they're going to follow suit. Bitcoin has performed, you know, a lot better than many other currencies and many other stocks for that matter. But for some, it's still too risky an asset. The markets in crypto assets regulation that's been put out by the European Commission is really helpful because it provides transparency, it provides some guidance, and that will help increase adoption, increase transparency, and then institutions will feel more comfortable.
Do you think that's a certain eventuality or close to it?
I do. I do. And the reason for this is I know clients of large banks are asking the large banks to say, I want you to help me buy cryptocurrency and I want you to help me hold it and I want you to help me store it and sell it. And it's at the point where those banks are developing solutions. So it's not because they think they're going to make money out of a quick thing, but it's because their clients or an existing clients are asking for this. As a business, that's a good place to start building a product. There is a need that the customer has stated. And the question really is, how many customers and is it viable to have this solution? And are we going to make money out of this? And therefore, what I know from some of the global banks is that they're now developing solutions. So they see that there's money in it for them.
And I'm assuming that the interest of certain hedge funds and things like that in the digital asset itself, does the kind of Wild West aspect, not much compliance put around it yet, is that attractive to people because there might be outsized returns because of that?
Exactly. And certain hedge funds will play off that. But I guess the clients of hedge funds may not like that risk exposure, as the case may be. Although I imagine if they're dealing with hedge funds, they don't care. They just want the return. And that's their own appetite to risk. But no, that's exactly it. And look, the key thing with crypto, what I say to everybody is, you know, especially at an individual investor level, be prepared to lose it all, right? You have to have high tolerance for risk and it is like placing a bet. So if you put a grand in, it may double, it may triple, but you also might lose everything. And what I'd say, I guess, at a more mature level is the way I think of crypto is have a portion of your portfolio invested in crypto, but make it a very small proportion and one, as we touched on there, that you're prepared to take a bath on and lose it all. Do I think you should switch up the mix of equities and bonds and property and cash and have a heavy weighting in crypto? If your risk tolerance is off the charts, then yes. But otherwise, no.
Lori Kyo, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to meet you. Thank you for having me on.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.